And now, the tradition continues as WABC presents John Gambling with the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Mike Bloomberg.
And Johnny Donovan, here we go once again. Yes, indeed, Friday get-together with Mayor Michael Bloomberg here on the John Gambling Show. Mr. Mayor, good morning.
Good morning, John. A little bit of rain, but it's supposed to be a nice weekend.
Absolutely, and of course, it's a Super Bowl weekend. You just heard the mayor of East Rutherford saying that his town should have the victory parade, but either way, New York City has one on Tuesday planned, right?
I have refused to talk about it. I am not going to jinx the Giants' chance. They're going in as the underdogs, and I am going out there to root for them and have a great time, as will everybody either watching on television or out there. But go Big Blue.
Absolutely. Again, we can talk about it just a little bit here, but I think that they have a better opportunity because they come in with really nothing to lose and everything to gain, and the Patriots going for their undefeated season, a lot of pressure.
You know, listen, they're both great teams. They wouldn't be in the Super Bowl if they weren't the two best teams in the NFL at the moment. But I think the Giants showed their heart. To me, the most impressive thing was everybody thought they would just slough through the last game with the Patriots because they had nothing to gain in terms of standings, and why run the risk of getting hurt? And instead, they went out there and they played their hearts out. And if a ball had dropped left versus right, kick had gone this way versus that way, they could have won that game. So I think that was a very important game for the Giants because they showed they are as good as anybody in the NFL. And any given Sunday, they can beat any other team. Let's just hope that this is one of those Sundays.
That's absolutely so. It should be exciting. Should be a good game no matter what. And, of course, we are all cheering for the New York Giants. Let's see.
And I'm going to represent 8.2 million people out there, all of whom asked me to go.
You're not going to paint your face blue or anything, are you?
I don't think Diana would like that. It probably would get me on the front page of the tabloids, but nevertheless, I think I'll pass that opportunity.
There are probably more dignified ways to get yourself on the front of those tabloids.
Well, the Tisch family has owned half of this team along with the Maras for a long time, and I think the only thing that's a little bit sad, and I thought Stephen Tisch said it when they won the division championship, it's a shame that Mr. Mara and Mr. Tisch, who really built this thing, didn't live long enough to see the Giants, I hope, win the Super Bowl, certainly in it. And I didn't know Mr. Mara. His family is one of the great families in New York. I know a few of them. But the Tisch family, I've known all of them, including Bob Tisch and Larry Tisch, both of whom long since passed away. But they are great New Yorkers. The Tisch family's always been very generous and work very hard and care, and it's an interesting family. They run from left to right in the political spectrum. They are doing everything they can, all parts of this city. They've devoted their lives, some of them to public service, some of them to paying more taxes, which we like. And it's a wonderful thing for the families too. I saw Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, on television for a couple minutes this morning, and he was beaming. And this is for the people that are really involved. It means even more than it does for the fans. They put their heart and soul into it.
Well, it should be a great game. I'm looking forward to it come Sunday night. Let's see here. Before we go to the break, we have a couple of minutes here. Your reaction, I can only assume positive. The announcement today for Michael Chertoff and Elliot Spitzer about the security money for the tri-state area.
Well, we need money. I don't think there's any question that when you catch a terrorist, the map in his pocket is of New York. And it isn't that there aren't other risks. There are always risks. The issue with giving out Homeland Security money, unfortunately, politics requires some of it to be broadly spread around. But you've got to differentiate between things that would hurt this country and terrorists would more likely to strike than from things that would just be disastrous if they were hit, because you can't put everything every place, so you have to exercise some smarts as to where to give out your money. And then, obviously, the devil's in the details when it comes to New York City. We have the world's greatest police department, 37-odd thousand uniformed people, 55,000 total. We have a budget of $5-odd billion. We have 1,000 police officers dedicated to intelligence and counterterrorism, and we have the resources to help other communities. And my concern is that when this money comes, that it goes not to projects that just giving a little bit to everybody in the area, but to go where the likelihood of a strike is and where we can spend the money intelligently. If you read stories about some of the Homeland Security money going to buy equipment for small towns throughout the country that, you know, great places to live, and they're great, you know, taxpayers, Americans, voters, but they don't need some of the sophisticated stuff because you're not likely to have a sophisticated kind of attack in those places. And this just becomes, unfortunately, a big honeypot. And let's see how the money actually gets distributed.
All right. It's a lot of money, Mr. Mayor. It's a 50% increase from $98 to $152 million. Is that just the recognition of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, and those folks down there? Or is this something that they've actually had some information that this is where the money truly needs to be spent?
Well, we've made the case to Michael Chertoff repeatedly, ad nauseum, and I even saw him last Saturday night at dinner, and it was a social dinner of 1,000 people in a big ballroom, and I said, just to go on the record, Michael, I don't ever want an opportunity to pass where you and I meet where I don't say we need more, and we both had a big laugh about that and went about having a nice evening.
All right, Mr. Mayor, hang on here. Let me take my first break. We'll come right back. Don't forget, later on, before we finish up, your chance to ask the mayor the questions, 1-800-848-WABC. If you want to get in the queue, now is the time, 1-800-848-WABC. Michael Bloomberg, John Gambling, back in just a sec. WABC. We continue on the John Gambling Show. Mayor Michael Bloomberg and you at 77 WABC. Mr. Mayor, the commission, by a vote of 13-2, said that congestion pricing in their form, starting below 60th Street, is probably a pretty good idea. This goes to Albany now for action, correct?
Well, it goes to Albany. It's part of a process. The Speaker of the City of the Assembly, Shelley Silver, wanted a commission to look at it. The commission was had on its membership, people from all different levels of government and interests, and they came out 13-2, which I think is a very favorable result. There are three things that a congestion pricing plan has to address. One, by the end of March, we have to have a plan acceptable to the United States Department of Transportation. If we are going to get the $384 million we were promised as a demonstration project. And in my heart of hearts, I really believe there is no wiggle room in that date. The current administration really only has a handful of months left to stay in office, and this is money that lots of other states and congressmen and senators want to get their hands on, but Secretary Peters has cobbled together the money from a variety of different pots. They would like to see it in New York, because if it works here, then it's a good example to what other cities of what they can do. And the second thing it has to do is relieve congestion. The number of cars is strangling our economy. It is polluting our air, and it's contributing to greenhouse gases. So we've got to get fewer cars. That's the second thing the plan has to do. And the third thing, the plan has to raise a lot of money for mass transit. The $384 million from the federal government, most would go to mass transit, a little bit to the implementation of the plan, but most to mass transit. But the fees that this plan would generate would be roughly $500 million a year, which we need to invest in mass transit. And if you take a look at the state budget and the state balance sheet and the city budget and the city balance sheet, there, and the fact that we've just raised fares on the MTA, there's no extra money anyplace for mass transit improvement. So we've got to do something, and we've got to do something now. And I think if you were to not do it now, you would really send a message to a lot of businesses that there's not going to be the ability to expand in New York City. You'd send a message to the public that nobody's got the courage to stand up and face the hard decisions. And remember, this is an election year for some, but next year is going to be an election year for others. There's always an election year. We've got to stand up and do what's right here. So the plan that the commission came out with is a plan that would accomplish all three of the objectives: get the money from Washington, reduce traffic, generate mass transit funds for constructing mass transit projects and improving mass transit. And there, the plan that we had originally suggested would have done that. This one does that.
Can you live with the modifications?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I can live with anything, John, as long as it does the three things. You know, I've never had this not invented here syndrome that if it isn't my plan, it's not a good plan, or if it isn't my plan, I can't live with it. I can live with anybody's plan. If somebody come up with a better plan or as good a plan, fine. I'm just trying to get these three things done.
Let me ask the question. I don't quite understand it. Georgia Weber and I were talking about it yesterday. In the plan, it calls for a dollar surcharge on cab use, taxi cab use. Wouldn't you want people to use mass transit and then use, obviously, the subways if they had the opportunity, but if not, the cabs? And the surcharge seems to be a negative in that.
John, if you were going to design the perfect system, politics notwithstanding, you would have buses and subways free. You would have taxis at a very low rate, and then cars would have to pay for everything. That's not politically possible. That's not realistic. We have to spread the cost of a very expensive mass transit system, one I think does a great job, but it is expensive to run, and it's going to get more expensive as we add security, and the workforce gets paid better, which they hope to do over time. And so there's always going to be some charge on mass transit. The taxis, I think, and you have to talk to the commission, but I think what they're trying to do is, since the difference between our plan and their plan, one of the differences is they have fewer cars that would pay the fee because the border would be moved from 86 down to 60th Street, and fewer cars would pay the fee because they wouldn't charge cars who are already in the zone from moving around in the zone. We were going to charge them $4. They're going to charge nothing. So they've got to come up with a revenue some other ways.
I understand,
and that's
it
one
now.
Of the ways.
That makes perfect sense.
And a dollar a ride, you know, I know people are going to scream and say, oh, you're callous, a dollar's an enormous amount of money. It is, but it's more expensive, but somebody's got to pay. And this is a way that everybody pays some.
All right, a story today that MTA budgets, not what they expected them to be, that could impact the Fulton Transit Center, the Long Island Railroad, Grand Central Connection, Second Avenue Subway. I thought these things were all budgeted for.
Well, I'm not on the MTA board. The city does have four members, and I did ask one of them the other day whether we've been kept posted, and yes, we have been. I think a couple of things are at playing here, John. One, because of the success of the city, construction costs have continued to go up. Steel, cement, labor, all of these things keep going up because of the success of the city. And maybe the budgets weren't set that high. Another possibility is they weren't at all that realistic. They didn't cover every eventuality. Another possibility is that the current budgeters are saying, hey, you know, the trends of higher costs are going to continue, and maybe they will, maybe they won't. Predicting the future is a very difficult thing. I think with the Fulton Transit Center, the most important thing is what's taking place underground. It would be nice to build something on top of it that attracts you to come in, but the most important thing is that we get the easier transfer between all these subway lines at Fulton Street, and that's going to go ahead. Second Avenue Subway, it's important that we keep it going. Number 7 line is probably, extension is probably the most important mass transit project in the city. It will open up the entire west side, and the city's paying for it, and the city will get its money back by development that will take place. This will be the next Gold Coast of New York City, an enormous amount of development. There are 5 developers vying, most of them with tenants already for part of their space, vying for the right to build on the west side. And they're not going to build unless the mass transit is there. That's something that, if you remember, the Reichmans, who developed Canary Wharf in London, were promised by the British government that the subway line would extend to Canary Wharf. It didn't. Nobody rented. The Reichmans went bankrupt. The government extended the line, and the people that had bought the property from the Reichmans just made a fortune. Nobody's going to make that mistake in New York City.
All right, before we go to the half-hour break, one final point on the congestion pricing. What's the Bloomberg fear factor that Albany might do, instead of getting politically involved here, do nothing and let the March 31st date fly away?
Well, you can only hope that it doesn't happen. I've always been optimistic. I think when everybody stops all the rhetoric and looks and says, look, what are our alternatives? No mass transit improvements for the foreseeable future, that's just not something that the public can live with. It's not viable. We have to do something. Okay, are there alternatives? Nobody's come up with any alternative that reduces traffic and raises money every year for mass transit improvements and gets us the $384 million. So if that's the case, nobody likes the choice of going to the public and say you're going to have to charge more. I don't like doing it. But the realistic thing is we've got to improve mass transit, and I don't see any alternatives that are realistic that will give people confidence that we are going to really start right now improving mass transit other than this or a version very close to this. You can still tinker with this, but this is essentially the design that does the three things we need, and nobody's come up with anything remotely that would remotely come close to doing the three.
All right, Mr. Mayor, hang on. We've made it to the half hour. Let me take a break right here real fast. We'll get back to you in a second. We start, of course, our break with George Weber. George?
WABC.
It's a Friday John Gambling Show with Mayor Michael Bloomberg at 77 WABC. Mr. Mayor, I know you're an observer of national politics. Your reaction to the stepping aside of Rudy and Edwards?
Well, the public had half a dozen candidates on each side. We're down to three on one and two on the other. Democracy works. I would like to see them speak out more on the issues that I care about and I think the public should care about, and I'll keep hammering away at them to get them to do it. But I don't think there's any question that the public has had the ability to express itself. We would have been better off if there had been four regional primaries, and Super Tuesday is almost one of those. It's sort of like a half a country primary, because I want more people to be able to participate. And the people of Iowa, people of New Hampshire, people of Nevada and Michigan and Florida have had more influence clearly than the people in all of the other states. But it is better than what it used to be before, and I think that we should, during the next 4 years, set as an objective to get a really intelligent policy of letting everybody participate in the primary process. Don't make it partisan. Don't make it a handful of states having a disproportionate amount of influence. Make it so that everybody can have a say. But having said all of that, democracy works, and we'll see what happens from here. Each of the candidates has the ability to make themselves known to the public, to answer the tough questions, express what they would do, and then the public will have some choice. And I think they'll have a choice from very different places on the political spectrum with very different views on all of these major issues, and that's what democracy should give you.
Results from Tuesday, will they give you an opportunity to reevaluate your personal situation?
Look, I'm not a candidate, but I think Tuesday you've got something like 22 states, including a lot of big ones. And it's interesting, in the Republican Party, the Republican Party rules are winner-take-all. So you are much more likely in the Republican Party to come out with somebody that's the prohibitive favorite after Tuesday than you are in the Democratic Party, where it's proportional the way they allocate delegates. And so one candidate could win a state, the other could come in second. But if the spread isn't very different, the results really are just tied in terms of the number of delegates. And so for the Democrats, there's more of a chance, it seems to me, of the process going much later, even maybe all the way to the convention. And then they're going to have a problem of should they have seated Florida and all this sort of stuff. But both parties have wide open races at the moment. There are more than one viable candidate in both parties, and that's good for the country.
Before we get back to the city stuff, a question. Exxon reporting record profits, $40.6 billion. The Shell oil company, record profits in Europe, more than they ever have. Obviously, the price of gasoline and oil contributing to these. Is there a limit somewhere? I know you're a free market guy, but these numbers are huge.
Well, the issue here is not the profits of the oil companies. The issue here is there's a group of countries who have gotten together in a what would be highly illegal manner of strangling our economy if they were domestic companies. And these countries have raised the price of crude and have hurt our economy. We are now we're at fault as well, incidentally, for not getting weaning ourselves away from the dependency on oil. We're just sending this country is just sending all its wealth overseas. I don't think people understand the magnitude of the money transfers out of our pockets into overseas, and then we complain when they come and buy some of our companies. Come on, keep in mind, we buy a lot of their companies as well, but they're just doing it with the money we've sent them. Some of those countries fund terrorism. It's an outrage, but this country is unwilling to face the issue that we are dependent on petroleum, a great deal of which is pumped up overseas, and unless we can get ourselves away from that, we are always going to have this enormous problem where others control our destiny. And, yeah, the oil companies make a lot of money. I don't have any idea. You know, they don't make a lot of money in downtimes. They make a lot of money in uptimes. How much of it is their reserves are just worth more or people are using more oil? I don't know. I'm not an economist in the oil on the oil industry. But the biggest problem is OPEC, not the oil companies. It's OPEC that is colluding. They have this cartel they formed, and they are sticking it to us. And we're not doing anything about it. Now, you know, what can we do? We can't go to war with them, but we certainly can reduce our dependence on petroleum. And that means nuclear, I suppose. That means wind. It means biofuels, some of which work and some of which, incidentally, use more energy than they generate, whether just a farm bill rather than an energy bill, a kind of solution. But nevertheless, there are things that we can do. We can go to compact fluorescent light bulbs. We can go to hybrid cars. We can go to using modern technology. Hopefully somebody will figure out how to sequester CO2 so that we can use coal, because coal is a fuel source that is very abundant here, and we are not going to stop using it, I don't think. And in China, that's their biggest source of energy, and it pollutes the heck out of the atmosphere so that they breathe, and also creates greenhouse gases that are, you know, really every scientist seems
to say. Speaking of greenhouse gases, did you hear former President Clinton, I believe he was in Denver when he made this comment, that he thought that one of the only true ways of attacking greenhouse gases was our economy and the advanced economies of the world to slow down?
I don't know where he comes up with that. You'll have to ask him. I do know that what we're doing in New York City is what others can do. It's practical. We can implement it now. We're planting 1 million trees, which will clean the air. We're greening the roofs, which will hold water and so to help our sewer system and reduce the amount of energy we need to cool in the summer. We're going all our taxi fleet to hybrids, which will use a lot less gas and generate less pollution and greenhouse gases. And we're going right down the list, compact fluorescent bulbs, everything that we can do in our city, making buildings green, to reduce our consumption. And I'm not an expert on the whole world's energy, John. My job is to focus on making New York City as efficient and as friendly to the environment as it possibly can be, and not slow down our economy. And at least in New York City, President Clinton may have been talking about the country. I'm not sure exactly what was on his mind. I can tell you in New York City, we can improve our environment, make this city greener, and make it good for business. One of the reasons companies in New York do so well is the quality of life here is so good. Life expectancy in New York City is better than the country as a whole. For big cities, we are very efficient per capita. We still have a lot of pollution, but we're going in the right direction. People want to come and live here because they know we're taking care of our environment. That generates jobs because companies follow the workforce.
On Monday, you were in Albany talking to the legislature about money and allocations to New York City. This week, City Councilman Peter Vallone suggested maybe we need to secede from the state of New York and become the 51st state. You for or against?
Well, I don't think we're going to secede. I've known Peter Vallone and his father for a long time, and I think he said this tongue-in-cheek. That's not going to happen. You'd require a change to the state constitution, which we'd never get, a and you require a change to the federal constitution to go from 50 to 51 states. So that's not going to happen. But I think the message that we are exporting our money to the rest of the state and to the federal government is the right message. And not that there's anything wrong with us doing it. I'm a believer that those that have to help those that don't. New York is the economic engine of the city and really of the country, and it's our job to help people who aren't living in the economic engine. But you can't damage the economic engine. You can't take so much away from it. It's like OTB. We make money in OTB. The monies go to help the state, go to help the racing industry, supposed to go to help the city. But the state is taking so much, the city gets nothing. And if we're not going to put our money that we should be building schools with and paying our teachers and firefighters and cops and everything, we're not going to subsidize a bookie operation. And if we don't subsidize it, then it's going to close. And it's a perfect example of trying to take too much away from the economic engine and destroying the engine. And that's what I tried to say to Albany. We're willing to pay our fair share, but we have budgetary problems just like the state. The difference is we have cut every single agency 2.5%. We've cut every single agency 5% next year. There's not going to be anybody spared. We're still going to keep the city safe and clean and growing. And I think that, in fact, those kinds of cuts are healthy because it forces every agency to look and see whether everything they're doing is valuable. People that don't ever want any cuts are wrong. All you do is you get sloppy, and not only do you waste money, but the quality of what you do declines. Whereas if you've got to worry about whether everything works, the quality goes up. And we've cut our expenses, and in fact, if you think back, we've raised our taxes. New Yorkers are paying their fair share, and we're sending money up to Albany, but they can't get so greedy that you kill us.
Randy Weingarten said the 2.5% you want out of the education department, you can't do that midstream. She's crying about that.
Well, we all live in midstream. I am somewhere between birth and there's nothing magical.
You're midstream. You're swimming upstream and you're midstream.
Well, I certainly hope so. My 99-year-old mother thinks she's middle-aged, and let's hope she is. Seriously, I think the small cuts are healthy and everybody can do it. And the one thing I'm not going to put up with, which we did really, maybe I just wasn't sophisticated enough the first time when we had to cut back in the 2002 and 2003. What agencies tend to do is they take the most popular program, they take all the savings out of that, close that down, and tell the advocates, by the way, the mayor's going to be coming up the steps of City Hall on Tuesday about 11:05. That's when you got to get out there with your signs, and we'll have the cameras there, and we'll yell and scream and vilify them, and we'll roll them. This time, we're not going to do that. This time, every program is going to pay their fair share, the small cut. The school system, actually, because half the money of the school system, or a lot of it, comes from the state, the cutback of 2.5% in total funds really only translates to, in city funds, really translates to something like 1.7% of total funds. So they even have it easier than other agencies because they've got all the state money coming in. But every program can be cut back, and nobody's going to ever convince me that a cut of 1.7 or 2.5% is going to hurt. I think it's going to help. And then let me also add, why should we be surprised that a union leader or an agency commissioner doesn't say, hey, I don't want it to apply to me. I'm sure they don't. But if we're going to keep the city going, it's got to apply to everybody. It's the only fair ways, and that's what we're going to do.
All right, Mr. Mayor, hang on. We've got questions from the audience. 1-800-848-WABC is our telephone number. When we come back, you ask the questions. WABC. Couple of more minutes left with Mayor Michael Bloomberg here at 77 WABC. Mr. Mayor, we've got questioners on the phone. Let's see here. Let's start with Terry in Queens. Terry, you're with John. Good morning.
Hi. Hello.
Go ahead.
Mr. Mayor.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. I live in New York City, and I think it's really unfair that the people who live in the immediate city are going to be charged $8 a day just to come back in. I'm a person on disability, and I think that the people who live on the outside boroughs, it's fine. But I think for the people that live directly into the city, for them to be charged just to come home is kind of unfair.
Well, let me say this. Number one, nobody likes to pay. I appreciate that. The political reality is that you can only do things if everybody participates. So there is that. And keep in mind, you will be a big beneficiary if you live in New York, in Manhattan, or if you live in any other boroughs with improved mass transit. And actually, the improved mass transit goes up north into Westchester and Rockland, where Metro North goes, and goes out to Long Island, to Nassau and Suffolk County. So, you know, whether it's Staten Island, Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx, or Manhattan, or one of the surrounding counties, we all need mass transit. There's just not going to be any more roads, and this is polluting the air. It is wasting your time stuck in traffic. It's inhibiting jobs from coming here, all of this extra traffic, and we've got to do something about it. And no matter who pays, that person is going to say it's unfair, but it's a little bit less unfair if everybody pays some. So that's really the reality.
David in Brooklyn, your question for Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Write to it, please.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, Mr. Mayor. Is it possible? Hi. You did a phenomenal job with the seatbelt rule with enforcement. Is it possible the police could ticket the people talking on cell phones, which I see every single day, causing accidents or near accidents, and it really scares me as a driver.
You know, seatbelts and then airbags have cut the number of traffic deaths in this country from something like 55,000 a year down to under 25,000. And I've been pleased to say that Johns Hopkins School of Public Health was the leader in really getting seatbelts many, many years ago. Anyways, that's one thing. You're right, sir, that the people talking on phones, their hands aren't on the wheel. They look down at the keyboard when they dial. There are some solutions, you know, one of these earpiece devices, voice recognition where you can dial. But the bottom line is we should be enforcing the law. The police have a lot to do, and it's harder to do. I will say when I'm standing talking to somebody on the sidewalk, as cars go by, I always look to see how many people have seatbelts on. And the vast bulk of people in Manhattan driving really do. When you get out into the suburbs, it seems to me, when I look at the streets, it's even a little bit higher. So that's good news, but you're right. There's an awful lot of people that talk on the phone, and it diverts their attention, and it is dangerous. And
all right. I think we have time for one more, Mr. Mayor. Let us go to John in Manhattan. What's the question? Right to it, John.
Mr. Mayor, off-track betting and Naira. Off-track betting in New York is the only, and I emphasize only, operation in racing in the nation that is separate from the track, and that's why you have a whole layer of executives making $200,000 salaries when it should be integrated with the track.
John, we got to get to the mayor. Go ahead, Mr. Mayor.
All right, look, John. Number one, it is separate and it should be combined. I couldn't agree more. The question is how to find the ways to do it. The city wants a revenue source. The state wants a revenue source. The racing industry wants a revenue source. The people who work in the OTB want to keep their jobs. So everybody's got their own interest. Hopefully the legislature, along with the governor and with some input from the city, because it's here in OTB, we'll be able to, before the session finishes in the next couple months, come to a solution. But you're right. We have a lot of overlapping bureaucracy, although I will protect OTB and say they actually do a pretty good job. The trouble is the state takes 120% of their revenue.
Mr. Mayor, go scream loud for the New York Giants.
I will do that, John.
We'll talk to you next week, and go Big Blue. We'll talk more about the Giants coming up with my buddy Bob Papa.